briefly explaining in somewhat more detail why it is usually difficult when one has a system with a gauge symmetry to reduce it to the actual physical degrees of freedom before quantizing it, and then also the quantization of that itself tends to be difficult. However, we'll actually see now, after wrapping up this part about the canonical quantization, there is a way of doing that in a path integral formulation. And I hope to be giving more details about this starting tomorrow. OK, now then we again discussed Dirac quantization, and where one just starts by kind of ignoring whatever symmetries or redundant degrees of freedom are there. So one just goes ahead and quantizes the theory as if it was just a regular theory. And then one imposes constraints as conditions on the quantum states. So one quantizes all one's first-class constraints, and then this one says, well, physical states are those that are annihilated by all of the constraints. And then we had also something we called Dirac consistency in order for this to lead to a sensible kind of reduced quantum theory. OK, now, whenever the constraints are linear in the momenta, there is usually not great difficulty in interpreting what they actually do. So they tend to just implement the action of whatever gauge groups they were forming in the classical theory. They tend to implement that on the wave function. So the wave functions, the physical wave functions, would be those that are invariant under gauge transformation. So if you move whatever their argument, if their field argument, if you move that by the relevant gauge transformations. OK, now we've seen that that was true more or less for the momentum constraints in GR, but certainly not true for the so-called Hamiltonian constraint. So the Hamiltonian constraint, to start with, is not linear in the momenta, and I already alluded to a number of problems one has with in dealing with it. So first of all, that factor ordering problems arise, because that is something actually I mentioned a number of lectures ago, that the kinetic term is not just a straight kind of a p-squared with momenta, but it has a field, there are field-dependent factors in there. So and how you choose the relative ordering of these p's and q's in GR for this kinetic term is a priori not fixed at all. So you can be sure that at least you'll probably get ambiguities. Well, of course, in reality, the problem is somewhat different, that one is struggling to find a single ordering to actually make the quantum algebra of these constraints closing. And certainly with the kind of the simple naive factor ordering I gave you yesterday, with all the momenta to the right, even at a kind of a formal level where I don't worry about where do the operators live, what are the boundary conditions, et cetera, is this mathematically well defined, the algebra actually doesn't close. So there's clearly more trouble to be expected there. Now, another problem that has also been alluded to is really what's the interpretation, the physical interpretation of the Hamiltonian constraint, or as I also now called it, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So the quantum version, whatever this is, of this classical constraint. And in particular, one should ask the question where is time, or what is time in this picture? Because the equation there didn't have, certainly didn't look like a Schrödinger equation, so time wasn't appearing anywhere. And another way to see that time doesn't have its usual meaning is just to look at kind of the Schrödinger quantization. You see, I remember I wrote down the GR action classically in the form with the Lagrange multiplier, so in the form p, q dot, minus, and then Lagrange multipliers times the various constraints. Now, and of course, you can in principle isolate what you mean by Hamiltonian. We also wrote down an explicit expression for that. So now what about if I simply use this Hamiltonian to write down a Schrödinger equation, as I would simply usually do, right, in the canonical formalism? So let me just take some time-dependent wave function. So, and just write down the Schrödinger quantization, the Schrödinger equation, where now on the right-hand side appears the Hamiltonian constraint. So this is just a formally quantized thing, you know, with hats on top. But this was simply the linear combination of the four constraints, depending on, the multipliers n and ni. T applied on psi of t. Well, that is a regular looking Schrödinger equation. But then, of course, this is a linear combination of the constraints. So if psi was physical, so if it was annihilated by the constraints, then it certainly follows that this entire right-hand side is zero, right? Because here you're just applying the constraints on the physical wave function. So what this says is, well, your wave function doesn't actually depend on time. So isn't that strange? Does it mean there is no evolution in time? So this somewhat bizarre fact leading to the time independence of this wave function is also called frozen time. Because time seems to disappear, which is, of course, in contradiction with what we believe GR is about. So there are certainly time-dependent phenomena we would describe, I mean, clearly both in the classical and certainly also in the quantum theory. Now, the way kind of this is interpreted usually is to say, aha, well, this is just a property which we already know to be present for reparametrization invariant theories, you know, like, let's say, a parameterized particle. And the same happens here, as I already mentioned, in this diffeomorphism invariant system. So then the conclusion one usually draws from that is, well, one should then isolate something one wants to name a time variable from among the dynamical variables of the theory. So somehow extract a time function. And that will then be a physical notion of time. So that's a kind of standard way of dealing with this. So kind of time must be recovered from among the kind of the dynamical physical degrees of freedom of the theory. Now, another remark I wanted to make about this Hamiltonian here, or rather kind of the Hamiltonian constraint, well, which has a kinetic and a potential piece, but again, somewhat unusually, the signature of the kinetic term, as you also calculated in yesterday's exercises, is actually indefinite. So it's not a positive, definite metric on the space of momenta, if you like, the squared space of squared momenta. So that was the observation. That's a De Witt metric. It's curly, what I called curly G, ij KL, has indefinite signature. And of course, times, well, locally at a point x, but that's true everywhere. So there is a minus sign in this metric. Now, usually for a normal series, that would kind of spell disaster because it will say, well, kind of the Hamiltonian is actually unbounded below. But here again, this Hamiltonian has a different status from what it has in other series. So one could hope to be able to live with this. And what I should also, one thing I should point out, this indefinite signature has absolutely nothing to do with the Lorentzian character of the matrix. So even, of course, you can write down, if you like, Einstein gravity with the identical equations, formally identical action and equations of motion on a space of Riemannian matrix, four-dimensional matrix. And nevertheless, you will still find that the metric on the space of matrix turns out to have indefinite signature. So that's not where it comes from. And rather, if you looked a little closer at the specific mode of the metric that gave rise to this minus sign, it's the mode that corresponds to an overall scaling, so the so-called conformal factor of the matrix. So this produces this minus sign there. And we might get back to this in the context of the path integral, where you also, this causes you specific troubles. Now, however, given now that this indefinite signature is there, that suggests actually somewhat of a resemblance of this equation with an equation we know well from field theory, namely the Klein-Gordon equation. So that's the Klein-Gordon equation, say, for scalar fields. And of course, this is just the wave operator. So this also has, well, it has one minus sign. Well, it has an indefinite signature. One minus sign with our conventions of writing the Lorentz metric. So there is some similarity here. It's also quadratic in the derivatives. And here was actually quite a nice way that gives you induces a scalar product on the space of solutions to this equation. And well, the scalar product, initially, if you look at all solutions, is again indefinite, so that which is useless for physical theory. But if you restrict to positive frequency solutions, on that sector, it happens to be positive definite. So it's a bona fide usable Hilbert space scalar product. Now, that was very early on also noticed that one could try a similar construction here. Unfortunately, I mean, to find a scalar product, as I also earlier told you, we want to have on the space of physical wave functions. Unfortunately, there is no analog, no good analog of the restriction to positive frequencies. That makes reference to an underlying Minkowski metric. And in general, we just don't have that here. So unfortunately, it doesn't quite work the same way here in gravity. Now, so this is one of the problems I've now made somewhat explicit to you. There is a host of other problems, so ways one might try and make sense of the canonical quantum theory of this. And an excellent reference to learn about all of those is a paper by Isham, which you can find on the archives, QC 9210011. That's called Canonical Quantum Gravity and the Problem of Time. And there you'll find a nice description of all the problems on more than 100 pages, explained in great clarity and great detail. Now, you might say, well, that's a long time ago. Haven't many things happened? Well, that's true. And some of those I'll be telling you in what follows. But really, some of the essential problems are still with us, unfortunately. So that raises, of course, the question, well, is one kind of really stuck in this canonical way of trying to quantize gravity. For the full theory, I mean, that's what we want to quantize, full GR with all the degrees of freedom, that more or less seems to be the case, unfortunately. However, of course, what one might try and do, and that has, of course, been tried by many people, is to look at, to make sense of the equations, the constraints, in a simplified context. So there are two situations that suggest themselves. So the first one would be cosmology, where already classically you get rid of almost all of the degrees of freedom in the metric by making strong symmetry assumptions. And then you can try whether you can make sense of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation there. Or you could think of a semi-classical approximation, where you really, again, now in the slightly different context here, there's a canonical context, try to find solutions to in a kind of WKB approximation for physical wave functions. OK, but how these analyses, to the extent they do work at all, and are non-ambiguous, which is also not really the case, to what extent they tell you anything about the full theory is highly unclear, I mean, to put it mildly. So unfortunately, one really has to address the full problem to make some progress. Now, back in the mid-80s, this whole canonical quantization program received a really a new impetus, because there was a new idea that came up, and that was basically its origin was the proposition to use classically new variables to describe GR. And these were kind of connection variables. So these were called the new connection variables. And the person who promoted them was Ashtekar, starting in 86. And so classically, it just amounted to a completely equivalent reformulation of GR, but using these different variables, a different way of canonically quantizing the theory suggested itself. And that's, I mean, has grown into a big research program over the last 25 years or so, and goes by the name, or at least used to go by the name, of loop quantum gravity. And what I'll be giving you here is really a description of the key ideas and some key expressions in a nutshell. I mean, the general background is, again, is a variant of the covariant quantization approach. And we'll see also Dirac quantization reappear now in a slightly different setting. So what's the key idea? So it's to work with a classically equivalent formulation of classical GR. In particular, it's kind of a so-called first-order formulation. I'll tell you in a second what this is. Where your basic variables are an orthonormal frame of GR in terms of orthonormal frame fields. They're also called tetrads or fear binds. And let me call them little e with two indices, mu and capital A of x, where mu runs from 0 to 3, and so does A. And this latter one is an internal index, internal SO31 index. And a so-called a spin connection. Spin connection omega mu a b of x. Considered as independent variables. So let me spell out a little bit what this means. So what is what's a Fierbein field? Well, it's roughly speaking, sometimes it's called taking the square root of the metric. So what's the relation, the algebraic relation that relates this Fierbein e mu a to the metric, the space time metric g mu nu? Can you still read this bottom line here, if I write here? I'll try. Sorry, so the relation is g mu nu equal to eta ab e mu a e nu b. And this is a kind of an internal Minkowski matrix, the eta. So you see what one has done here in order to go kind of to these tetrads as a basic kind of configuration variables. One has introduced new degrees of freedom. So these here, I mean, really, they literally, they define a frame, so just a basis of tangent space, if you like, and that frame. And they're also normal, which means just refers to the appearance of the flat Minkowski metric here. And you see, this is now this frame, of course, this frame index carries a non-trivial gauge symmetry. Because if I now perform an SO31 rotation on this internal index capital A, it leaves, by virtue of this relation, it leaves g mu nu invariant. So what I've factually done by introducing these new variables, I've introduced an even larger redundancy, but of course, to achieve something else in the end. But I've added new degrees of freedom. And one expects, of course, there will now be more symmetries. And there are, of course, as I already told you. So there is an SO31 symmetry on those here. Now, what is the spin connection about? Well, before I had just the metric indices. So you know, I can talk about a metric connection, which just tell me how anything with a kind of space-time index, how it behaves under covariant differentiation or under parallel transport. And now, of course, that I've introduced objects which carry this new internal index, I also need a connection that tells me how objects that have one or more of these indices, how they behave under parallel transport. So how they, there is of course a corresponding covariant derivative, and which would not also needs to know about this spin connection in addition to knowing about the usual Levi-Civita connection. Okay. Now, cutting a somewhat long story short, that's actually not the connection one works with, but one takes a specific function of these spin connection coefficients and arrives at a new connection variable. So that was the essence of Ashtekar's work. Then one performs a 3 plus 1 decomposition, as we've done for the metric variables. And then, well, one sees, and then let's have a look at what happens. So you make this Le Ronde transformation, or let me call it kind of a 3 plus 1 split, completely analogous to what we did for the metric variables. And also, one fixes the gauge partially so that what is left over of this internal SL3-1 symmetry are only SL3 rotations. So one essentially fixes what happens in the zero direction, and kind of there is a residual gauge invariance which reduces to that of SO3. So we perform and partially fix the gauge so that SO3-1 symmetry is reduced to an SO3 symmetry. And then one ends up with a pair of canonically conjugate variables. And these variables are remarkable because they look entirely like a set of Young-Mills conjugate pairs with a connection variable and a kind of generalized electric field variable. So one ends up with these kind of Young-Mills-like conjugate variable pairs satisfying Poisson brackets as follows. I'll write down the what they are, these objects, in a second. So the A, they're A fields that are connection fields. B, there is a kind of electric field, capital E. And they essentially up to a constant, they have canonical Poisson brackets. Two delta functions with respect to the two different types of indices. Three-dimensional delta function. So here ij, as I've been using before, is a spatial index. So again, we made we performed this reference foliation into a sequence of spatial manifolds sigma, and now objects here have spatial indices, and AB refers to, also takes values 1 to 3, and it refers now to the SO3 index. And really what this A here is, so I'll be using from now on kind of a notation. Maybe I'd better go to the other board. Curly A for the space of connections. So that's the space curly A. It's now kind of Lie algebra valued connections. But so this is where my fields live. Half of my conjugate variable pair. So you should think of those now as your configuration space variables. And so this is an SO3 connection. It has a spatial index because it's a spatial, it's a one form. So it really has all the properties you'd expect it to have from a a Young Mills, a gauge potential. And this A is now an internal index, which in our case refers to this SO3 internal gauge group. And of course, what characterizes the connection is how it transforms under local gauge transformation. I have the relation down later. Now, the conjugate momenta carry a spatial index upstairs and an SO3 index downstairs. And so they're, of course, also algebra, gauge algebra valued. And how they relate to the original tetrad fields is that they're essentially, well, the reduction of this object, where the indices still run from 0 to 3, to the same object, where now the indices run from 1 to 3, so there's a spatial and an SO3 component. And a density factor has been included. So these are called densitized triads or dribinds, if you like. Now, these A's, of course, a natural variable to consider if you have a gauge potential is its associated curvature. Is that a problem here? Oh, yeah, there is definitely a problem with the Mesmer indices. What about that? OK, well, of course, these indices are pulled up and down, well, with the metric, respectively, the Minkowski. I mean, the internal metric or the external metric. Am I doing this right? Yes. OK. No. This is now like up to this density factor. This is the square root of the metric Hij. OK, so it obeys a similar relation where now the eta AV is a delta internal metric. It's really the delta ij, if you like, or delta little a little b. But otherwise, it bears the same relation with the spatial metric as I've written down there, kind of the square root like relation. So here we have an associated curvature field. So Fij A, which kind of up to the way now the coupling constants appear, or you have decided to include them in this relation, in this definition, is just consists of the first derivatives of the gauge potential, as usual, anti-symmetrized over the spatial indices, also as usual, plus, now this is, of course, a non-abelian gauge connection. You pick up a term that's quadratic in the A's. Gn squared, this is Newton's constant, ABC, AB, I, A, C, J. OK, where you've appropriately defined the signs here for this epsilon tensor. And this, of course, where does it come from? This comes from the structure constants of the gauge algebra of SO3, or almost equivalently SU2. Yes, question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, does this formula for Fij, does that follow directly from identifying these as conjugate variables, or do we have to also identify it as a connection?
No, it's a standard construction that when you're given a gauge connection, right, that this is the corresponding field strength.
The fact that it's a connection, does that follow directly from this, or it's an extra?
No, this you had, of course, to show in deriving what these capital A's actually are in terms of your original variable, that it has that transformation behavior under local SO3 rotations. OK. So And that's a longish derivation, which I don't have, you know, time to present here. So you just have to swallow this. But you know, as I said, all I need to know, in principle, I could completely close my eyes, give you these connection variables, and, well, that's more or less what I'm doing here, and then give you the relevant objects of the theory. In this case, it will be the constraints as a function of those. And just say, believe me, classically, this is just equivalent to classical GR in the normal way of writing it down. Okay. Of course, it has a special feature that you know you picked up even more degrees of freedom. So, of course, we expect more first-class constraints to appear. And this is exactly what happens, as we'll see. So now, in terms of these variables, we now get seven first-class constraints. So seven times infinity cubed first-class constraints. Okay, let's see what they are. So first of all, you get now three new constraints. That really are related to this local gauge degree of freedom, SO3. So there is an index A for running from 1 to 3. And they have the following form, partial derivative of the E field, the generalized electric field, Gn, Newton's constant, epsilon, ABC. A, I, B, E, C, I. And that's, of course, nothing but a covariant derivative with respect to this connection A of the field E. So I, let me write it as a kind of curly D, I, E, A, I. And this has to vanish. So these are three conditions. And they're called the Gauss constraints. Then, of course, we still have our old friends, the momentum and Hamiltonian constraints. But now they take, of course, a specific new functional form with respect to this new set of variables. So momentum constraints, curly H. Now, you'll see the fields, I mean, there's a curvature of A appear, Fij A Eai equal to 0. So these are my momentum constraints. And finally, the Hamiltonian constraint, H perp, has the following form. Epsilon ABC. Now the curvature appears again. Now with a determinantal factor in the denominator, determinant EAI. And it's quadratic in the E fields, EA, BJ. Minus a term b squared plus 1, a beta squared plus 1 divided by beta squared. That, again, the determinantal is density factor appearing. Then I have a term that's quadratic in the E fields again, antisymmetrized over A and B times Gn Aia minus gamma Ia times an identical looking term. G and AJB with different indices, J and B, where I'm not giving you the explicit functional form. This gamma is essentially, it depends on E, and it's again an S, is an SO3 connection. We don't need its explicit functional form. Yeah. Just to know that it depends on the momentum variables. Okay, now, maybe first of all, we can do some degree of freedom counting. Yeah. So, you see, these are both of these indices. I'll let you just copy this first. So both of these indices, so these are my configuration and momentum variables. Right? How many are there of those? 3 times 3, 9. Okay, so I have 9 canonically conjugate pairs, and I have 7 constraints. So I've added 3 degrees of freedom, exactly the SO3 rotations, and here is the associated first class constraint. Of course, you should have asked me what this parameter beta is all about. But you didn't. So that's the famous Imirci-Barbero parameter. This is just a complex, non-vanishing, in general complex, non-vanishing constant, which just appears naturally in the construction of these variables. It just seems to be there as a constant in these relations. Now, we see that it reappears in a quite crucial place. Well, we find it back in the Hamiltonian constraint, at least in this way of presenting you the constraint algebra. Now, what people initially did when first coming up with this Young-Mills formulation, or what was, it wasn't present, I mean, this, nothing was known, I mean, it wasn't formulated with this arbitrary beta parameter in there. But effectively, the choice one made for beta was beta equal to I. And you see, it beautifully kills this terribly messy second term here on the right in the Hamiltonian constraint. Now, unfortunately, it also renders the already the classical formulation as you might have guessed. Now, an I will appear here on the right-hand side. The classical formulation becomes complex. So I have to add, there's in principle nothing wrong with that at the classical level. I just have to keep track where are my physical degrees of freedom and where are the physical real parts of these objects I'm using as my fundamental variables. But once you try to quantize the theory, it really becomes very difficult to deal with this complexity in a proper way in the quantum theory. So this has all been all but abandoned in canonical quantum gravity. So nowadays, one sticks with the real beta. And of course, it has this disadvantage that one really has to tackle. If one wants to solve, say, the Hamiltonian constraint, even at the quantum level, well, one has to deal with this form of the constraint. Now, so the reason why people, so this simplification, well, then you basically have something that looks like F EE apart from this density factor. And then, of course, the constraint algebra looked just so much more simple than it did for the in the metric case. And what got people very much excited was to say, aha, look, now our theory, at least kind of kinematically at the level of the basic variables, looks very much like a Young-Mills theory. Can we import quantization techniques that have been useful in QCD, in Young-Mills theory, and can we apply them to gravity? And that's really what one has tried. So, so let me briefly say some more things about this. First of all, one can compute now the classical Poisson bracket algebra of these things, and it closes. So it is really an algebra of first class constraints. So that's remark number one. And then, of course, immediately one says, OK, now let us try what we did in the metric formulation. Let us perform a Dirac quantization of this. So one uses kind of formal, one puts hats on things. So again, one works with a kind of a formal Schrödinger type quantization for these basic variables with canonical commutation relations for the A and the E field. So which are just like the classical brackets with an additional IH bar in them. Delta IJ del 3 XY. And formally, well, you just represent them by multiplication and partial differentiation, as usual. So now the A's have the role of configuration variables. So they act on your wave functions, which are now then taken to be functionals of the configuration variables A by multiplication. And similarly, the E fields act now by partial differentiation, as you'd expect. On these same wave functions. H bar divided by I, 8 pi eta del by del A JB X applied on these wave functionals psi. So now, formally, now I'm saying, aha, well, these I identify, again, formally as my wave functions. And they constitute now, kind of they span what before I called the auxiliary Hilbert space. So these are my unreduced variables, which still have the redundancy now with respect to both the gauge transformations and the diffeomorphisms, of course. Now, let us concentrate for the last 5 minutes or so on these Gauss law constraints. So you can look, of course, what they do kind of classically. So taking Poisson brackets with these objects, you can read off that they act as generators of gauge transformations, infinitesimal gauge transformations, on these fields, really exactly in the way you'd expect in the Young-Mills theory. Now, the same turns out to be true if I now, according to the simple-minded recipe, quantize these constraints here. So if I represent these GA hats now as operators, by which I mean I simply substitute, I leave them in this order, and I simply substitute this E by a partial differentiation, then up to some irrelevant constant, as this becomes just proportional to the following expression. Functional derivative with respect to the A field on psi, this should equal zero. And so this is again an instance where the constraints are linear in the momenta. So it has really a straightforward meaning of generating gauge transformations. And this equation has a straightforward meaning of being solved by wave functions that are constant along the orbits of SO3 gauge transformations. So this is solved by functionals which are invariant under local gauge transformations. And these are parameterized, well, this is kind of an element of the gauge group, so the local gauge group, which of course now depends on X. We're talking about local gauge transformations. And now this is the characteristic transformation law for the gauge potential, which I've talked about, but now I'm reminding you what it looks like explicitly. Take my pick out a specific spatial component. So this is now Lie algebra values. I'm suppressing the algebra index. Then this G, a local gauge transformation, acts. So this is a gauge transform. It's a notation for the gauge transformed gauge connection. And this, by definition, is G to the minus 1, so inverse G gauge transformation acting on AI, then the gauge transformation G itself minus G to the minus 1 partial derivative of G. So, and this object lives in a space now for us that's I call, well, hopefully not. I've used this maybe before this notation, but here this denotes just the infinite dimensional local gauge group, which at each point is a copy of the finite dimensional group SO3. But it depends on X. So it's an infinite dimensional group. And so I should say, so SO3 is what naturally came up. What one often uses, and well, in part for computational simplification in GR, one goes to the double cover of SO3. Of course, the Lie algebra is the same. Okay, there are minor global differences between those two groups. So often, this is what one uses, SU2 transformations. Now, sorry, I need to have an extra 5 minutes from you today in order to explain kind of a nice property one is now making use of, and one is copying from Young-Mills theory. So you see, again, we have now a situation where we have a gauge group acting, and where we really want to work with the physical objects. So things that live on the quotient space of configurations A, where I consider two A's as physically equivalent, if they are related by gauge transformation. So again, in principle, what I'd like to do to go to the space of orbits with respect, now to start with respect to these local gauge transformations. And as I told you before, well, the usual problem is, when one does that, how does one parameterize the space of invariant objects? And there is a very nice set of objects which are explicitly gauge invariant and which depend on these A's. And these are the so-called Wilson loops, or Wilson loop variables. So what kind of objects are these explicitly gauge invariant? Functionals of my connection variables are so-called Wilson loops. Now, what is a Wilson loop? I write down some symbols for you, then I explain what I mean by them. So I call this W for Wilson. Gamma denotes a closed loop. We'll get to that later. This object is a trace of a certain group-valued matrix. And the matrix is the so-called holonomy. And let me write it like this. This introduces a bunch of unknown symbols to you. I'm aware of that, but I'm getting this in a second. So this object, the P, stands for path ordering. Now, this here is the integral around some closed curve gamma of the connection A. You exponentiate it, essentially you get a group element. So A is algebra valued, in our case, say SU2 valued. Exponentiating an algebra element, you get through a group element. Now, you do that along a path, and your gauge group is non-abelian. You have to worry about in which order you multiply things together. And that P gives a specific prescription of how to do this. So this is, and then you have a group matrix, and then you take the trace of it. And that turns out to be an invariant of A. And there's another name for this object under the trace, and this is called the holonomy. Holonomy. And this here is called the path-ordered exponential of A along the curve gamma, the closed curve gamma. So what is the picture one has here? I need to give you one more definition in order for you to be able to do these afternoon's exercises. So here one is now bringing in dependence. You had a manifold sigma, or a special manifold. Now one is bringing in an explicit dependence on paths on sigma. So what's a path on sigma? It's a map from an interval, a closed interval, of the real line to sigma, a continuous map. So let me call this little w. It has a parameter. It's parameterized. That is just inherited from this interval on R. So this is my initial point W of S naught, and it has a final point W of S one. So this is a path in sigma. So formally, I can write it just as a map from this closed interval into sigma, and explicitly, you're mapping this parameter S, think of it as a path, a parameter, is mapped into a point in the manifold. Sorry, that's not a gamma, a W. I'm getting ahead of myself. And of course, if you are in a local, say if you are in a local chart, then of course it will be some x mu. So that's these are its coordinates in locally in sigma, my three-dimensional manifold. Now, a loop is very much the same with the additional condition that I identify, it will have an initial point will be equal to the end point. Right? So a loop is an object which I call gamma, because I used that in the definition here of the holonomy. And let me make a specific choice for the interval on the real line. Let me parameterize going from 0 to 1 into sigma. So same story, S, the parameter S is mapped onto gamma mu of S. And now specifically, gamma of naught and gamma of 1 have to be identified. Now, given my gauge potential A of x, local gauge potential, so I can write it in various, exhibiting the various types of indices it has. So to start with, of course, it has a spatial index as a one form, dxi. But now I can also exhibit the explicit dependence. It takes values, of course, in the Lie algebra SO2 or SO3. And now let me introduce an explicit basis of generators for that algebra. Let me call those capital X. So then that's really what I have. These are really the components I was working with in the Poisson brackets. Capital XI are my generators. So these are three, in my case, three algebra generators. In the kind of fundamental representation of SU2, in my case. Now, given this setup, now to start with an open path, what defines this object? It's defined as a unique solution of a specific linear differential equation. So let me just write it down, and then we're done here. So the holonomy of a path W mu of S with initial point S naught and end point S1 is the solution of the following equation of the holonomy. I have to give it a name. U index W S S naught. Sorry. So it's a function also of A, but I've just suppressed the A here. So A is one of the given objects in order to make sense of this. So I'm taking the derivative with respect to the path parameter of this object. So I'm writing them kind of from right to left. So that's the initial point, and that's the point where I'm looking at the curve at S. This is supposed to be the AI should call this AI of X D W I by ds u w of s and s naught. This must be true for every s in this interval I'm considering, so the entire path. So, okay, x here is, of course, just the point where I happen to find myself on the curve at the parameter value s, w of s, and with initial condition for the path, condition. If I look at this object and I just look at the point where s is equal to s naught, the initial point, then this gives me the unit matrix . So this is a unit in, whatever, in this case, SU2. So it's plausible. Well, so this must have a unique solution, unique when I give you the initial condition. And the statement is that this defines this bizarre object here. And in the exercises, we'll look at some more properties of this. It's an important object, of course, also in Young-Mills theory proper. So apologies for running over. Won't happen again. I see you again tomorrow.